Hello again, and welcome to Watch the Media. I'm John Schrader. For those of you who listen to this show regularly or even semi-regularly, you are aware that I'm a soccer guy. I broadcast it, I watch it, I try to stay on top of it, I write about it, I research it. We know soccer broadcasting is being disrupted by the delivery of the product. The best example is Apple TV Plus and what they call MLS Season Pass. They're going into season two of a 10-year, $2.5 billion media rights deal with Major League Soccer. That's here in 2024. But others, the NWSL, the USL, are getting bigger and better television deals as well. Some of those going over the air and some of them streaming. Along the way on this adventure, this journey in soccer, we bump into interesting characters. Today, I'd like to share with you a conversation I had with one of those interesting characters. He's a Scotsman, Steve Caldwell. He does a little work on Apple TV and a lot of work on Canada's top sports network, TSN. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Oh, and don't forget to keep listening to the part where he says who he thinks will be the number one soccer league in the world one day.
Yeah, I was born in Stirling, Scotland, central Scotland, in 1980, and kind of grew up there with a younger brother and then eventually a younger sister, 9 years younger than me. And my brother and I were inseparable. We played a lot of football. We were obsessed with the game, and we loved everything connected with it, going to games, playing football, watching football on TV, which was less accessible in the days than it is these days, but we still managed to find it in different places. And after my high school, I had the opportunity to go to Newcastle United in the English Premier League, and I played there for 8 or 9 years, kind of played 40, 50 games. I had a bit of an experience and then decided I wanted to go and play more regular football. Moved on to Sunderland, which is the rivals in Newcastle, for anyone who knows. So it was a big step, but played in the Championship and sort of spent the rest of my career between the Championship, English Championship and the English Premier League. And was fortunate enough to play a good few hundred games, play for the Scottish national team. And in 2013, I was given an opportunity to come and play in MLS with Toronto FC. So I thought it was a perfect timing. I was 32, I believe, at the time, and I felt like it was a challenge that I could take on that would be exciting for me, and I could experience a new environment, a new league, a new way of doing things, and just loved that experience. Had a couple of years on the field and then had an opportunity to retire into the organisation, more in the business side of sport, learn the ropes with Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment, the parent company of Toronto FC, and learn a bit about basketball and hockey and soccer and the business of it. And yeah, stayed in Toronto, broadcast with TSN, which is one of the major sports distributors in Toronto, or in Canada, I should say. And I've kind of remained around the business of soccer. Have a sports tech business as well. I'm a president in academy. I do my broadcasting, amongst some other things, coach a bit with the Canadian men's national team. So I'm very fortunate that I still have a lot of opportunities in Canada to be involved in the game.
So when, Stephen, did you think that you wanted to be a broadcaster, or when did that kind of opportunity present itself, and had you been thinking about it?
I was fortunate enough, John, to do a bit of work when I played in England in broadcasting. I'd been on a couple of shows. I did a few games when I had been injured or suspended. So I knew I enjoyed it in my kind of mid to late 20s. I came here, and one of the biggest shocks for me coming to MLS was the length of the off-season, especially for a team like Toronto at the time, where we didn't make the playoffs in 2013 and 2014. And I was twiddling my thumbs, and I was kind of sitting around. I predominantly stayed in Toronto with my family. We didn't like leave and go back to the UK because the kids were at school and stuff. So I reached out to a very good guy, Mike Massaro, who was our head of communications at the time at Toronto FC, and said, is there any channels who would be interested in maybe having me join the Premier League show? And Sportsnet did some work and TSN did some work in that space. They shared the games, and fortunately for me, TSN took me up on it, and I did some games while I still played, filled in a few areas, and just slowly over time, as I retired and as I kind of moved into different things, I just kept getting more and more opportunities in broadcasting, and realised that I thoroughly enjoyed it, and took up pretty much a full-time role there from about the end of the summer 2016 onwards.
What is it about broadcasting that most interested you and maybe continues to interest you?
Great question. I enjoy it because to me it reminds me a lot of the game. You know, it's obviously you go out there and you perform on a kind of weekly basis, and you hope you do a good job, but you have good days and you have bad days, and you gotta kind of prepare. You gotta do your training, which is similar, and you deliver a performance on the day. And like I said, some days the words are flowing and your timing's perfect, and you just feel like you got it that day. And then other days it's a bit of a struggle. And I always enjoyed that side of sport. Obviously, you want to be perfect all the time, but that's never the case. So I see similarities in that. I think most of us that have played the game, you know, miss the game every single day from retirement, probably till the day you die. So you can never quite replicate that. But I see the similarities in broadcasting, and I really enjoy sharing my knowledge and my views on the game with a country that's still very much growing in the soccer landscape. It's really changed a lot since I arrived here in 2013, you know, 10 and a half years ago. Soccer growing so much in Canada that I'm pleased that I played a little bit of part in that as a player, and then obviously now do that in a national basis through broadcasting. So it's amazing. It's a fun space. You can still kind of have a bit of a life, which is a difference, I guess, from coaching, where it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Broadcasting, I feel like you still have a bit of flexibility, and I thoroughly enjoy it.
You can still have a life, is what you said. You can still have some goodness of life. How did you learn the business, and who helped teach you? What you know, because there's so much, as you know, it isn't just sitting down and talking. You know the soccer part, that's the easy part, but you have to learn the TV business. And how did you learn that?
Yeah, I you know, in the beginning, it's such a shock, isn't it? You sit there and you think it's, I mean, you're trying to replicate the feeling of sort of sitting in the pub or sitting in a coffee shop chatting about the game with your mates. But it's totally different when you first start, because you get these cameras on you and you got someone in your ear, and it's confusion. Where do you look and when do you react? And you get timings, and you know, you gotta shut up when you're told by your producer. So it was a bit of a shock to me at the beginning, but I always felt like I had the potential to get better, and I was so fortunate that I had some really great people to learn from in the beginning. And the first people that I'll bring up are my my colleagues on TSN on a pretty regular basis. Luke Wildman, who is play-by-play and host for most things that happen in soccer in Canada. Brilliant guy, thorough professional, just taught me what it meant to study and be prepared and be ready for that broadcast. And my analyst colleague, Christian Jack, who another fantastic guy, longtime journalist, and who was on TV with me at the time. And they two guys really showed me the work ethic that was needed to succeed in broadcasting, and the amount of kind of detail that you have to put into the preparation and the work so that you can perform to your best and find that kind of natural voice and that relaxation, I'll call it, on television that you need to in my opinion, to be a good broadcaster. So I learned from two of the best. I had some tremendous producers along the way. Laszlo Stel is a guy that I'll bring up who was fantastic for me. He taught me things, like really shared some knowledge that he'd learned through the years with me to make me better, and wasn't afraid to tell me when there was areas I could improve in, because, you know, I have this athlete's mindset, so I always want to get better. And to get better, you got to accept that critical feedback and take it aboard and you know, and become authentic to yourself. Be your natural self as much as possible on camera. And I think I got there. It took me a few years, but I think I got there eventually, mainly because of the outstanding role models that I had at my disposal.
How much input have you ever been allowed to the content of the program? Can you call up the producer and say, hey, I think we need to do this, 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 and this? And have you been aggressive about that? And have you been allowed to do that?
I have been allowed to do that. I'm quite an aggressive person. It might be my Scottish background, but I'm quite opinionated. I'd like to think I'm very respectful of people's roles and where you sit in their roles. But I am someone who speaks my mind, and I've been fortunate again that I'm at a network where, on a weekly basis, we are very much part of the content of the show. We have, you know, the call 2-3 days before the show, and we discuss maybe what we're going to talk about. And obviously, everybody has a voice in that conference call or in that meeting, and everybody will be heard, and then we make a decision. And again, a lot like playing in a team, you know, everybody has their opinions, and a coach will accept the opinions, then he'll make the choice and he'll say, this is what's happening on any given Saturday. So it's a similar thing for us, but I feel like I've in the beginning, you're a bit quieter and you want to leave it to the experts. But then eventually you hit a point where you start to feel like you've learned enough and you get enough experience that you can give your opinion. And, often I would say, the opinion might change from what you think the best way to go is, because of some of the advice from your colleagues. At times your way is the best way, other times it's somebody else's way. But I think if you have this learning mindset and kind of an open eyes and open ears, I would say, to like what is best for the show and how we're going to kind of take the viewer through this experience of a game or of a tournament or whatever it may be, then I think that you know, we get the best work when it's like that. So I've learned when to be vocal, when to shut up, when to kind of be strong about something, and when to just accept that somebody else's idea is the best way or the best direction for the show to go on any given day.
Did it take you long or any time at all to realize that you had to be critical of maybe former teammates, of former opponents, of players, of anybody you like, or just players and coaches in general? Did you ever feel like you had to sort of put that, you know, veneer away? Yeah. Or were you always comfortable with that?
I was always quite comfortable with that. I was mostly a captain for teams that I played for, so I was used to being in, you know, conflict situations, half times, end of the games. You're always in that situation where, you know, if anyone that's been in a change room knows what it's like, it's high pressure environment, and it's about being critical and fair and honest at the right times. And like I said, it's when you get so many kind of alpha males in one space, you really need direction from leaders. And you know, I had that leadership role in a lot of changing rooms that I was in, and I listened as much as I talked. I must say that, and I think that's vitally important in any walk of life, that you listen to others, and you sort of have that measured approach when it comes to coming in with an opinion. But I try to be fair on a constant basis, to be honest, when it comes to my broadcast. And I would like to think I have zero bias, and I get a lot of stick from Toronto FC fans for this very thing, because they feel like, being an ex-captain of Toronto FC, I should be maybe leaning a bit towards them. But I take immense pride in the fact that I am completely unbiased towards any team. And I just try and give the opinions of the game. I think my love for the game is so strong, and my kind of duty to the viewer when I'm on a broadcast, that I really feel a lot of responsibility to be fair and to be honest, and of course to be opinionated. And it is my opinion, and everyone has a different opinion on this sport or any sport, but I feel that responsibility to just be fair and be honest. And I always felt that, I would say, in the beginning. Obviously you're learning the way, and you still feel like you're in the dressing room, but then when you realize that you've retired and you know you're on air to actually give opinions, then I've always felt comfortable with it. And you know, you bump into guys, friends of mine, guys that I've worked with in a coaching capacity, that I've probably analysed in a live game, it can be a little bit awkward. But again, I always stand by why I said a certain thing. I'm happy to speak to somebody's face and say, Look, this is my thoughts at the time. I have got things wrong. I will continue to get things wrong. That is the nature of the beast being in broadcasting. But again, I'm pretty open and honest when I'm wrong as well, either live on the broadcast or in private by saying, yeah, I got that one wrong and please accept my apology, and you move on, you shake hands, you move past it.
Is this something that you knew as a player and knew as a captain and knew as somebody who was a leader, that you have to defend everything you say or most things you say? And in broadcasting, and especially young students we work with, you know, you have to be able to defend and be prepared to defend what you say on television. Is that something you had learned all along, or you had to learn that sort of quickly in television?
Yeah, I think I had to learn it. I would say, you know, defend and explain, you know, justify your comment. I think that's a big thing in broadcasting. It's fine to have a comment. We see a lot of hot takes in many different sports. And as long as you can back up your take with some kind of evidence or some kind of information detail behind that, I think that's absolutely fair. That's what you're there for, to do. So, you know, again, the word defend to me means like you're going to say, yes, I am right no matter what. But there's so many times that I've made a quick call, and my style is to be very opinionated very quickly. And I'll say that is a penalty, that's not a penalty as an example. But then if I'm wrong, I'll be quick to say, look, I got it wrong. Like on the second or the third view, I realise that this is, you know, the ref got this totally right, and kudos to the ref. And so I try to bring that honesty to kind of every call, every broadcast. I hope I get more right than I get wrong, but you do get things wrong, just like you make mistakes as a player, and you know you pass it to the opposition at times, and you look at the back and you go, why the heck did I just do that? What was I thinking at that time? So it's the same thing. So yeah, you learn to be better. Experience, there's no substitute for experience. The old quote that everyone says, but it's so true. There's no substitute for experience, because you get into situations that you've been in before, and you feel a comfort in that, and a relaxation to be yourself and to kind of navigate through it. Whether it's, you know, you make a gut call quickly and it's absolutely right, and you know, you feel like you feel 10 foot tall and you feel like patting yourself in the back, or you make a gut call and you get it wrong. You got to just own it and be honest about it. And I think people respect you for that.
When you get lots of attention doing this, did you ever have to resist getting too full of yourself? Hey, Steven, I saw you on TV. You were great. Woohoo, you were awesome. You know, we can sort of get full of ourselves here. Do you have to resist that?
Yeah, of course, everyone does. But I think, again, my Scottish background really helps me, because I'm always brought down to earth by my two wonderful kids, my two boys, 15 and 16, Robbie and Will. They bring me down to earth very often and tell me how poor my call was or how many mistakes I made. I got a family that I've never been too enamoured by any kind of celebrity status, if we can call it that. You know, we've always been pretty down to earth people. So I think my background helps me in that. Again, I never get too down on myself, and I never get too high myself. I try and keep that kind of medium ground. But you've got to have a bit of an ego in this game. You got to have a bit of confidence to say, you know, I'm capable, and I can go out there and I can speak to sometimes millions of people and give an opinion and be strong on that opinion. So I think there's that healthy balance is always good, but I'll never get too far ahead of myself. I realise what I'm doing, and I feel a lot of onus on myself broadcasting to, you know, a reasonably new soccer country, to be that voice and to try and inspire young kids to play the game, male and female kids, to play the game or to get into broadcasting or to find a way into this tremendous sport. That is what I feel every time I go on air, that I'm trying to educate and inspire others.
Maybe you can help us sort of draw a picture here. The similarities and the differences in Scottish television, English Premier League television, not what we see in the US, because that's somewhat produced by the networks here, but, you know, the way it's done there and the way it's done here, some similarities and maybe some contrast.
It's a difficult one. I actually did a game for Sky Sports about a year ago. I was back in England and I did a championship game between Sunderland and Middlesbrough for Sky Sports, and I was actually surprised at the similarities. Actually, a lot of similarities to what I'd heard at TSN, and I guess at the stage that I'm at, kind of 7, 8 years of consistently broadcasting, that I feel very comfortable on air and very confident, I guess. But I found a lot of similarities. I think we've got to a point at TSN where we have a very settled group of analysts, hosts, and we know what we're trying to achieve. We have some brilliant leaders as well who are allowing us to be ourselves and allowing us to bring that natural personality, let's say, to the broadcast. So I think we've got to a point where we're probably a little bit British in the way that we do it, where it's less set up and less you talk then I talk then back to the host, and we try and have this conversation. And I found it very conversational when I was back in the UK doing the broadcast. The one difference I would say was probably the amount of times that the producer was in my ear in the UK as opposed to Canada, and the amount of kind of feedback or kind of where we were heading next, and sort of the flow of the show in terms of timings and stuff. That was different. I heard less from him. It was probably more a preference thing in terms of him knowing me and knowing what I like, as opposed to my Canadian producers who have worked with me for a number of years. I was very confused with the voice in my ear when I first started broadcasting. It was a real nuisance. And now I don't think I would like to even try a broadcast without that voice in my ear. I really feel comfort in it, and to hear that it's there, and to just sort of hear the updates, whatever it may be, from that producer is very important. So I found that a little bit different, but I think over time it would probably be more of a thing that you could discuss with a producer and have what suits you in your ear at that time.
The American audience sees games now on Apple TV Plus, but Canadians still get games on TSN. Is that what it is? And do you work for both and you bounce back and forth between the two?
Yeah, I do actually. We still have a package of games on TSN for the next few years. MLS, just a bit like I believe it's Fox that still have their package, don't they? They do some games. So we're pretty similar to that. We are doing, I believe it's about half TFC, half Montreal, and half Vancouver. So it's a kind of random process where we just have a sort of a game of the week, and we do that, or a game of the match day, I should say. With Apple, I've done a bit of work in Leagues Cup. I hope to do a little bit more. I really enjoyed my experience with Apple. They're obviously trying to make this league as big as possible. They're going to put some great resources into it over the next few years, I believe. So I think I'll probably start doing a little bit more with Apple and be truly freelance. I've always been freelance. The unique thing about freelance in Canada is that you're not exactly freelance, because you kind of tie your flag to a certain mast and you become that company. So people will think of me as TSN, but I've really genuinely always been freelance. So maybe as the years go on, and the way that broadcasting is becoming with the streaming services, and different properties having different networks or streaming services attached to it, that I think I'll probably become more freelance as the years go on, and hopefully work for many different companies and learn different ways and meet different people along the way.
Working for more people is better than working for fewer people, right?
Yes,
Absolutely.
exactly.
So how many games did you do? How many games do you do on average a year?
Oh, great question. I think last year I did 47 live games. I did, or maybe more, because I'm probably not even counting the Apple Leagues Cup games, but I think there was 47 games for TSN. So I got a lot of games. I try and hit the 50 mark. That's always amazing if you can get to that number of games. I'm a workaholic. I always want to work. So, I did the World Cup in Qatar for TSN as well. Wasn't calling so many games. I only called three Canada games with Luke, but I was on the air for most of the games. And when I was there, my producer was trying to give me days off, and I asked if I could just pretty much work every day because I just, when I'm there, I feel like I should work. So I always want to call games. I've called two games in one day before when we were maybe off tube for both games, which is a challenge. By the second game, you know, you really have to concentrate on kind of the names and the details, and obviously you've got your notes for that as well. But I love working. I really enjoy what I do, and if I can work as much as possible, it's good for me.
Most of the work is like color analyst for the games, and you do studio work as well. You do both?
Yeah, I do both. I never host, but I either do, you know, the sort of analyst seat for World Cup games as an example, or the Copa America draw we just did recently. We did the Euro draw as well. So any kind of studio show at TSN that is not being called live by us, I would probably be on it. If it's being called live by us, then Luke and I would probably be calling it, and Kevin Coban and Julian de Guzman would be the analysts in the studio. So I've done both. I enjoy both. I think, if I was to be honest, the color analyst is the best, because you're part of the game, and it's live and it's happening in real time. So that's probably my favorite. But I really enjoy when it's the big occasions and it's, you know, World Cup finals and that, to be sitting in the analyst chair as well.
So you were in Qatar doing all that work? You were in there?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say we were there for the 41 days, actually. We were there for a long time for the entire tournament, and a special experience to kind of be in the build-up to that. We did some of the warm-up shows, and we did a roster reveal show, and kind of warmed ourselves up, got into the set, and then did like every game live for TSN. It was a tremendous experience.
Too bad they only played three times. It was a tough, tournament. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Have you done much calling games in front of a television monitor, or are you always in the stadium?
No, I've done a lot of games in front of the monitor. I would say it probably first started a little before COVID, actually, when we would call away games off the monitor. We stopped traveling to the US so regularly. So after we got a little bit used to that, you know, it became more regular. And then when COVID came, we now do probably about 70% of our TSN games off monitor, which is a little frustrating. I mean, it's not the same thing. It's very difficult, I believe, especially for the colour analyst who's trying to find some other details in the plays and the game. But it is what it is. You get on with it and you know, you do it, it still work. But I'd much prefer being live in the stadium.
How do you try to overcome that? It's not the audience's problem to worry about, that you're in a studio trying to give them the feeling of being there. So how do you make that feeling? How do you make it work?
Yeah, I would say the best feeling or the biggest compliment is when someone's like, "What are you doing here?" Maybe like the next day or later that night, you're like, "What do you mean? Like, well, I thought you were in Atlanta." So they think you're actually at the game when you're in the studio in Toronto. So that's happened a few times. I feel good about that. Obviously, you're trying to, I don't know if the word's pretend, but you don't want people to know you're sitting in a cupboard and you're calling it off the monitor. So you're trying to have people experience the game as if you're there. These days, most educated fans probably know, they can tell the games that you're maybe not at. But it's something that you try and bring that same energy. I think sometimes you gotta be a little bit contrived at the beginning, because it's maybe a West Coast game and it's 10:30 at night and you're just like feeling a little tired, and you gotta give yourself a little pep talk, gotta get up for this, gotta be, have loads of energy in the voice, and then you just hope that the game's exciting and you can sort of like bring that energy. I think what I've found most about broadcasting, that, you know, I knew I always loved football. Obviously, I played since I was a kid and I was a professional for about 18 years. But when I went into broadcasting, I think I realized how much I love football by calling these different games, good and bad, in stadium, 80,000 there or 5,000 there are off the monitor at 10:30 at night. I love football. I see the intricacies and the tactics of the game and the psychology of the game. And so really, to me, it doesn't matter if it's the highest level possible or if it's maybe a lower level. I just love being part of that broadcast and being part of that game and trying to bring my passion and my energy to the call. And so it's the same when you're off monitor. You got to remember that there's thousands of others that would love to be in the same position. And again, the responsibility to bring the best that you can to that game is never lost on me.
Stephen Caldwell, soccer analyst and host, a Scotsman who spent more than a decade in North America. He's based in Toronto. He's with us this time around on Watch the Media. I'm John Schrader. How valuable do you think it is to developing that relationship with the audience that they know that you'd rather be no place else in the world than right there watching that game with them?
I think it's critical. I really do. I think that for sure the play-by-play guy is so important to the sort of experience of watching a game. I can remember it back to when I was a kid and some of the calls that you just never forget. My team was Celtic back when I was younger, and cup finals and some of the iconic calls by some of the iconic commentators in Scotland at the time, I'll never ever forget. So play-by-play guy has that that weight, I guess, on their shoulders and that responsibility. I keep saying responsibility, but it's like you're calling this thing for such an impressionable athlete or young athlete, and you want to make sure you get it right. And then the color guy's got to come in the back of it and add something a little bit different or say something that the viewer thinks, I never noticed that. You know, that I'm always trying to bring some insight to a goal or an incident that the viewer thinks, I never saw that. Wow, I can see it now. So again, it's you know, trying not to be too smart about it and being in the game and being natural, but also bringing that insight that others might not be able to bring.
You watch lots of soccer on television. What do you think of this sort of new generation of young announcers? And there are lots of them in North America. Certainly, there's never been more opportunity to broadcast. What do you think of this new generation of young announcers?
Yeah, I think it's exciting. I think we got a lot of talented people who are trying to force their way in the game and trying to find a space that's kind of suits them. I think that we you have to be natural within this spectrum. Like, you got to be yourself and you got to find your voice. And I say that because I feel like if you're always playing a role or kind of playing an act, it's very difficult to keep it up if you want to have longevity in your career. So I'm pleased that in the beginning I kind of recognized that. Otherwise, I feel like you would be sort of acting constantly. And again, you got to be yourself. You got to be true to yourself. If you can't be like anybody else, and I don't want to name names, but everybody has their style. And then you see some young guys coming through or some young people coming through, and they're trying to be like somebody else, and that never works. So I think authentic to yourself is very important, but there's a lot of talent out there and there's a lot of people who are vying for some prominent positions. And ultimately, it's about putting the work in and making sure that you're prepared, you're ready to go, and that you have certainly a knowledge of the game that you're calling, but also a naturalness to the way that you provide the analysis.
I have to ask this question carefully, but or not. Do you find that some announcers in U.S. and in North America, young announcers especially, who grew up watching English Premier League, maybe listening to Stephen Caldwell, maybe they try a little too hard to sound like their favorite UK announcers and not who they are or where they're from or what their experiences are?
Yes, I think a lot of people are influenced by others and feel like they gotta be a certain way. And I don't agree with that at all. I think like I said earlier, you got to be yourself and you got to be natural. It's certainly the best way to succeed over a long period of time. You might get some reaction if you're flamboyant or if you're aggressive and opinionated, and it might work for you for a little while, but I think over time you'll get caught out by that kind of style. So you gotta just be yourself, and sort of, like I keep saying this thing, find your voice, but I think it's very important, because I think when you're a young announcer, young analyst, you're struggling to kind of know what your true identity is going to be as a broadcaster, and it comes naturally, and you shouldn't search for that too much. You gotta just let it percolate, let's say, and it comes to the fore. And then when you sort of find this crossroads of kind of confidence and comfort and this natural voice, that it comes together one day. It's almost like one day you've been toiling for 2 years and you feel like you've been faking it kind of every broadcast, and it just arrives and you're like, oh, this is who I am. And it's a great moment, because once you get there, it really feels like it's not a profession anymore, or it's not a job, I should say. It feels like you get to do the best thing in the world and get paid for it. You sort of go in there and you are just sitting at the pub with your mates and you're getting paid for it. So I encourage everyone to kind of be patient and wait on that, put the work in, and do your research and kind of have an idea who you might kind of want to be in terms of the personality you want to portray. But eventually, when it comes to you, be patient. When it comes to you'll feel great when that moment arrives.
Do you remember when you had that epiphany, when that light went on, when said, "Hey, I know who I am and I know what I'm doing here and I belong"? Do you remember any particular moment that happened?
Oh, what a great question. I think so. I got to tell a good little story here. I think probably my color analyst role started. I did one game summer 2016, and then my colleague Jason DeVos left for a role with Canada Soccer, and I was thrust into maybe one or two at the end of regular season games in the playoffs. So by the seventh or eighth game in my analyst career, I was calling MLS Cup for about 1.5, 2 million people. And when I go back and listen to that, I'm like, oh my God, because I can hear how immature my voice sounds, and there's bits in my call and I'm like, oh my gosh, why did I say that? And I'm talking too much, I'm talking too long. Again, your cadence of when you talk and how long you talk, I think, again, it's only you can't replicate anybody else. But some of my favorite guys, they come in and they speak for 10 seconds, I almost time some of them. I'll use an example. Jim Beglin is one of my favorite Premier League production guys. He does most of the big games for Premier League productions. He's almost to the second 10 seconds every time he comes in, and I love that rhythm and that cadence that he brings. And so, in certain areas, I try and kind of replicate that. But to be thrust into a game that big so early was amazing, daunting, and also like very informative in terms of learning for the future. So as I went through that, kind of the end of that season, the next season, I had another MLS Cup. So I had two MLS Cups in one in a bit years. And then I had a Champions League final, CONCACAF Champions League final that TFC were in against Chivas Guadalajara in 2018. So I'd had these three major games in sort of 2.5 years. And I think I wish I could have them back. Maybe I'll never get them again, but I really hope that I get a chance to call a big North American game like that again, because it came very early for me and probably wasn't at my most experienced or my best. The moment that I felt that I really was kind of there was probably the 2018 World Cup that I did for TSN, Russia World Cup. I did it from Toronto, but I really felt I did every single game with Christian Jack and Luke Wildman, and we had the revolving seat for an extra analyst that would come in. And we did every single game. We were on air like every minute of the broadcast for a month. It was incredible. We were on air for like 8 hours a day, some days in the early stages when it was three games. And I was so prepared, as were my colleagues, and we just found this chemistry that was, you can't replicate. It was just one of the best experiences of my life. And when I finished that, I'm like, Right, I'm there, and I know what it takes to do a tournament like that, something that big, and I know what needs to go into it. And so fast forward 4.5 years, and when I sat in the seat in Qatar, I just felt so comfortable and so ready, so prepared, and so natural that I was really happy, like where I'd come, and you know, sort of 7, 8 years, I really felt like. This is fantastic. I enjoyed every minute. I was never daunted or nervous about anything. Well, natural nervous, but never like to a point where it was affecting my persona or my personality on air. That was probably the peak for me so far. But I'm a guy that always thinks you can get better and always thinks you can improve. So I'm hoping that I'm going to get even better and learn even more as I go through, you know, hopefully the next 10, 20 years of broadcasting and try and hone in my craft to be as perfect as or as close to perfect as possible.
Do you painstakingly look over your work and watch it and pick out all the things that can make your performance better?
No, I don't actually. I don't watch back every call, every broadcast. I don't think that that's great for you either. Obviously, we might touch on this in another question, but social media is there. You've always got people telling you how great or how terrible you are on a daily basis. I try to stay off that, but I think it's healthy to have a little bit of that as well, because you kind of want to know if you're making the same mistake, or you're being a bit too consistent with a certain phrase or something like that. So I kind of dip into parts of it. I'll watch a game or so, and I'll see if I've improved. I watch an old game, and think back and think, am I going further away from where I want to be as a broadcaster, or am I getting closer to that, you know, the striving for perfection that everyone tries to get in their life and their job. And so I'm kind of random when it comes to that, but I'm very meticulous with my preparation. I don't kind of say, right, I'm going to prepare for 4 hours here or 4 hours there and sit at my computer. I live in it all the time, so it's probably to the detriment. My girlfriend goes crazy because I'm picking up the phone at midnight or at 7 in the morning, because I just live in the world of research and learning and absorbing this information. That is how I do it. That doesn't mean to say that that's the best way to do it, but that is the best way for me. And it could be probably quite frustrating for family and loved ones around me, but I gotta know what's going on all the time, and just consuming it constantly is my favorite way to do that. And I think it really allows you to then sit down for the game and be comfortable that you're prepared enough to go and call it the best you can.
We have been wrestling with this question, this notion, since Major League Soccer was created in 1996. And that is, where is the balance between giving them the game and teaching them the game? And where do you think that is? And how much do you think we need to teach without, these old timers will say, I know the game. What are you talking about? Don't talk to me like I'm a beginner. So where is that? Where is that balance?
Oh, what a fabulous question. Well, we've discussed it so many times in the past. I believe that you've got to put on a show for the most educated of viewers. I think you've got to respect that there's people that love the game, that watch, you know, as many games as me and the boys do on a, you know, a weekly basis. And you've got to bring that value. You know, your role as an analyst or as a color analyst on a game is to, like we said earlier, bring that something a little bit special, a little bit different that others might not see. So if you're always trying to, sorry for the phrase, but dumb it down and you know, teach people that it's 45 minutes a half, and you know, offside means this, and you know, you sound a little condescending. But when it comes to major tournaments, you have to respect that there's millions of people watching, and only a small percentage of that viewership is avid fans that really know the game. So that the balance is so critical because you gotta make that I don't know, kid that the hockey kid that never watches soccer come back the next day and watch the game, or the mum that very rarely watches the games but wants to be involved with the family for the summer experience of a World Cup or a European Championships. You've got to make them come back the next day. So I don't know how to answer it. I'm kind of going around the houses here in terms of like the balance. It's again a natural thing. It's like you gotta kind of give the detail to someone who's not a regular watcher, but then you gotta give the high level stuff for the fan who watches all the time. But just a little bit of might be a sentence or two. You don't have to ram it home, but you gotta bring that something special if you want to be the best analyst you can be and tell people something that they haven't seen with their own eyes.
At the risk of asking this question to somebody who would like to do more work for MLS and Apple TV, what did you think of their first year's effort at bringing the games and how they did it?
I thought they did a fantastic job. I thought that the commitment to being everywhere was absolutely phenomenal. No mean feat to be all over, every game. Having the games at the same time, I thought brought its challenges. And I know that there's many people that say we got to mix up the kickoff times because we're watching less MLS. Guys that used to watch maybe like four or five games over a weekend or maybe watching less because their team's playing at the same time as a lot of other teams. But I think to put it on in English, to put it on in Spanish, to put the Canadian games on in French, send the crews to every single game, different production teams and trucks and all everything that goes into that. It was a great effort, and obviously everything changed in the middle of that when Messi came. And we got that renewed kind of excitement and content, I'll say, because Lionel Messi joined Miami. It made it even more special. I mean, again, I'm a little biased because my experience with Apple was Leagues Cup, but I thought they did an amazing job through the Leagues Cup, making that tournament significant right away. A lot of people critical, oh, this is a waste of time, and why do we want to watch this? Brilliant tournament, great idea. I hope the Liga MX teams are a little bit riled up for this season, thinking, the MLS team's probably got the better of them, and they bring a little bit extra impetus to maybe their play in Leagues Cup this year, because I think as this tournament becomes a real kind of rivalry and competition between all teams, but certainly between the two leagues, it's going to be a fabulous property, I think, for MLS and for North American soccer to really build behind. But I think Apple are going to get better and better every single year. When you look at a company like Apple, you can only assume things are going to improve as they go on rather than deteriorate.
I've heard they have a couple of pennies laying around that they might be able to invest in soccer. That's what I've heard.
Yeah.
What do you think the rest of the world thinks of North American soccer, of Major League Soccer?
I think it varies now. I mean, when I first came here, it was probably like, oh, why would you go to MLS? We had the kind of older guys who would go for a payday. They were a select few, and then guys like myself could not entertain it from a financial sense until we got into the latter stages of our career. And then as we were coming, it was probably with a mindset, oh, this is going to be a fantastic experience and I'll play a bit of football. But I think that mindset's changed that a lot. I don't think people come expecting to cruise around and have a holiday these days. I think people come knowing that the football's a high standard. I still think there's discrepancies in our game because, we have such a gap between our kind of lowest quality slash lowest paid player and our highest quality, highest paid player. So I think that creates some weird games where maybe the pace is a little bit slower, the standards a little off, the quality is lacking. But we also have some really fantastic games of football where it is truly, the advert a few years ago was our soccer, wasn't it? MLS, our soccer. It is truly North American soccer. It's so exciting. It's end to end. Anybody can score at any given time, and it's a fabulous watch. But I think if we want to be considered one of the top 10 leagues in the world, we've got to get more consistency. We got to obviously get more revenue in the game so we can start poaching some of these guys from Europe and South America. South America is a bit different. We're getting them younger. But let's use Europe as an example. In the top five leagues in Europe, can we get them over a little bit younger, maybe in their 20s? So they've still got a good few years of football. So we got to pay them more to do that, which targeted allocation money's helped. But we got to keep pushing the revenue up so we can get more money in the game. But I love it. I believe that it will be the biggest league in the world one day. I can't say when that day will be, because I think that we're very far behind English Premier League and the other top four leagues. But I think when you look at the cities that are in this great continent, and you see, the experiences, some of the players that have came already, it's only inevitable that one day that this will be the biggest league in the world. Could take 30 years, could take 40 years, but I think eventually we're going to have that tipping point. Messi's a big moment, but we're going to have more Messi-type moments where guys come a little younger to North America to play, and eventually this becomes really, one of the top leagues in the world.
I want you to say that one more time. I believe this is going to be the biggest league in the world. That's what you believe at some point?
I do believe it, and I've said it on a few occasions. I do believe this is going to be the biggest league in the world. And I want to qualify that by saying that we're a good bit away. I believe English Premier League is far and away the best league in the world now. A lot of that's because of money, TV money, and obviously the money that the teams spend. But the other leagues, France and Germany and Italy and Spain, and even some of the other leagues in Europe for me and South America are still a good bit ahead of the MLS. But when I look at where would I want to live and learn and play football, I'd rather be in Miami or New York or Los Angeles or Chicago or Toronto than some of the countries in Europe. And so I think eventually, just thinking of the size of this country and the way that we do things, it's going to be the biggest league in the world one day.
I guess all we have to do really is to look at what the NFL does, what the NBA does. Major League Baseball's had some trouble getting younger audiences, but they certainly have a whole lot of money. And maybe your time in here coming in 2013 is like an interesting benchmark, because in the last 10 years, the amount of money, the new stadiums, the new teams, the billionaire owners, it's just been almost indescribable how far this league has come in just that last decade. Do you agree with that?
I totally agree with that, John. I think when I first came here, there was some really great players, surprising players to me, but the overall standard of the squad was a little low, the money was low, there was a lot of things, of playing in some cavernous stadiums, and I know we still are on some occasions, but you look at the way teams have developed, some of the new franchises that have came in, the stadiums that we've built, the players that we've brought over, particularly in South America. You got guys like Almiron coming over to MLS and then going on to Newcastle, playing every single week in MLS. Castellanos, a recent one from New York City, who's playing at Lazio now and, was in Spain, is in the Serie A. And so we're getting the players. The players are coming. The stadiums are being built. The fans are coming to watch. It's growing. It is growing all the time. But we've got to keep it up, because we've got a long way to go. And we can't rest for 1 minute. We can't think, pat ourselves on the back and say, we're there, we've done it. We've got a long way to go. We want to, it's great to see some of these stadiums. There's 20,000 there, but we want to see 50, 60, 70,000 there at some point. And the only way, the best way to do that is keep improving the quality of the players. To improve the quality of the players, the club needs to have better recruitment infrastructure. They need to have intelligent front offices, more knowledgeable front offices, and we've got to keep growing the game in many different areas. Training grounds are getting better. We're building 10, 20, 30 million dollar facilities for teams to train at, and conditions that these players grow in is better as well. I mean, I was part of the 2015 collective bargaining agreement, and the things that we're arguing for then, I'm pleased to say, are given now. They're just assumed. But it was a real eye-opener for me, the things that we're trying to achieve for some of the players back then. What was that, 8, 9 years ago? Mm-hmm. And we're at a better place, and we got to keep pushing it. We can't rest for a minute if we want this to be bigger and better still.
At the risk of you saying, well, yes, Captain Obvious, what impact will the 2026 World Cup have on soccer in this part of the world?
Well, I mean, history tells us a huge impact. How big is hard to measure, I would say. I would say, as a cautionary statement, I really hope that we're prepared. And I mean that more in Canada than maybe in the US. I'm not so sure about Mexico, but certainly in Canada. When I say that, I mean, I hope that we capitalize on what this opportunity gives us. You know, it's one thing to put on a great World Cup. I've no doubt that our cities, our stadiums, the experience will be second to none. It'll be the biggest World Cup in the history of the sport. But I hope we capitalize on the build-up towards the World Cup, the experience going through the month or so that we play, and then beyond, we're ready to make it count, per se, and have, you know, better infrastructure, better facilities to play and to train in, better coaching, more pathways for young male and female players to get to the highest levels of the game, through Canada specifically, I'll say, because I live here, but through Canada and the US to sort of achieve our goals. Because I still think we've got a long way to go with that. I still think we're missing in some areas, and I can speak confidently and sort of knowledgeably about Canada, because I've part of an academy. I've coached the national team. I've been part of a lot of big games, a lot of big broadcasts. We've got a lot to go. We've got a lot to do when it comes to growing the game in Canada. And so we got to use this amazing platform that we've been given, the biggest and best platform in our sport, to capitalize on it before, during, and after.
I have to believe that all the FIFA people are seeing these dollar signs rolling in their eyes, because we talk about this being the biggest and the grandest and the most successful. It's going to be the greatest revenue producing event probably in history, don't you think? I mean, money, yes, is going to be incredible.
Incredible. I like, phenomenal. I mean, we're going to 48 teams. We've got all these amazing cities, huge stadiums. The ticket prices will be off the charts. I don't know how any normal person is going to buy a ticket for any of these games, but the revenue is going to be ridiculous, for sure. And I don't think anybody would dispute that. It's like, where are we going to, what part of the revenue can we get, and how can we capitalize on the whole experience to make sure that beyond 26, MLS and USL and Canadian Premier League is the, you know, the flagship leagues, and NWSL, you know, because this game is like, it's global. It has been for a few years, but it's also about building the game for both sexes, whether it's a male or a female World Cup. We got to make sure that young girls are watching these games, and they're seeing their pathways, and they have their aspirations to get to the top levels of their game. So we've got to be mindful of that as well. And I want to make sure, or I hope that we make sure, that after 2026, that we've really give, you know, this adrenaline shot to the game of soccer, and we can grow again as quickly. We talked about the 10 years of me being here between 13 and now. Between 26 and sort of 36, 40, where can this game be? That's what I'm talking about. That's where I think we can legitimately be one of the biggest leagues, if not the biggest league in the world.
And what a great time to be a broadcaster in this part of the world, right?
Yeah, I love it. I love this country, and I'm pleased for the opportunity to be here. And yeah, delighted to be part of the game in all forms, but especially broadcasting.
Well, Stephen, thanks very much for the conversation. I appreciate it. I've learned a lot, and it's been interesting, and it's been nice to get to know you a little bit, and appreciate it. Thanks.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it very much.
That's Stephen Caldwell, who works primarily for TSN in Canada, based in Toronto, a Scotsman who played in Scotland, the English Premier League, and Major League Soccer. Thank you so much for your time. I'm John Schrader, and this is Watch the Media.